And we are back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Three open congressional seats from Iowa are up for grabs in this November's midterm elections, a very rare occurrence in Iowa politics. Tomorrow on this program, we'll analyze today's primary results for those races. My guests, Kathy Obradovich of the Des Moines Register, Tim Hagel of the University of Iowa. That coming up tomorrow, Politics Wednesday. Last month, Governor Branstad signed into law a bill making substantial revision to our state's HIV criminalization law. The new law no longer is HIV specific. It includes the transmission of certain infectious diseases, for instance, also in addition to HIV, hepatitis, meningococcal disease, meningitis, tuberculosis. It's a new law that converts sentencing to a tiered system instead of the one-size-fits-all approach of the previous law. Last half hour, we heard the story of an Iowan, Nick Rhodes, convicted under the old law. This half hour, we want to get some perspective on the 30-plus years of the AIDS, HIV epidemic to find out how our understanding of the disease has evolved and how treatment has changed. Joining us to do that, Dr. Jeffrey Meyer, Associate Professor of Internal Medicine at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. He is an infectious disease specialist who has been treating patients with HIV and AIDS since the early days of the epidemic. Dr. Meyer, welcome to our program. Dr. Meyer, are you there?
Yes. Can you hear me, Ben?
Yes, I can hear you now, Doctor.
Thank you for having me on.
Thank you. We want to reach out to our listeners this half hour. If you have questions for Dr. Meyer about the HIV-AIDS epidemic, our understanding of the disease, its treatment, feel free to join our conversation. Toll-free, 1-866-780-9100, river-to-river at iowapublicradio.org is our email. Iowa Public Radio is also on Facebook, where you can post a question or tweet us at IPR Talk. Let me have you briefly react to the new law, if I could, Dr. Meyer. How does this new HIV criminal transmission law in Iowa change things from your perspective, if at all?
Well, I think it's a great step in the right direction. We used to sort of hear folks out there talk about testing as, well, get a test, risk arrest, and hopefully we'll be able to change that sort of idea. And I would like to encourage those that are at risk to get a test and be their best, because it's not only are they benefiting themselves and saving themselves, but they're protecting those that love them who they love and their partners. So I really think that this is a step in the right direction from a public health standpoint.
Mm-hmm. To encourage more people to get tested who otherwise would hesitate because they would think that they might get charged?
Correct.
Mm-hmm. Do you think it lessens the stigma at all?
I'm sure hoping that it does. That was one of the issues, that stigma was a huge issue, and this particular law actually elevated the level of that stigma associated with HIV. And so HIV should really be treated like a lot of other diseases and infections.
Let's have you take us back to the 1980s, and you as a doctor. When was it and where were you when you first became aware of the HIV-AIDS epidemic?
Well, I was in medical school at the time that the HIV epidemic got off the ground. The first cases actually were just prior to me entering medical school. But the time I got out of medical school, I had moved to Madison, Wisconsin, and worked in an HIV clinic at that time as a resident physician. And knew that infectious disease was an area that I was going to go into, and so I spent time in Madison working with HIV positives in the clinic and the hospital, and then I went out to the East Coast working for the NIH and George Washington Hospital in Washington, D.C. area. At the time, there was a lot of HIV and AIDS there. There was a high endemicity of HIV infection in that area. And it was really quite a devastating disease. I think that a lot of people really, perhaps the younger folks, really don't understand how horrendous that disease was. It was a horrible disease that led to really a slow death, and so it really was a death sentence. Having HIV was a death sentence because the drugs we had, even back in the mid-80s, really didn't turn things around. They just slowed things down, and so we had folks sort of having disfiguring cancers, wasting, indolent infections that just kind of gradually eat your body away. And so it was just a slow death And it was horrible. In fact, at the time that I was finishing up in D.C., I was thinking that, gosh, can I really do this the rest of my life? And it was after moving from D.C. to Iowa that we had new drugs come along. And that really changed the playing field.
Mm-hmm. Remind us how this disease progresses, the first step would be one would be infected with the HIV virus, and then what happens?
Well, let's say we just sort of take a population of individuals who are infected, and so it's sort of a bell-shaped curve, and in the middle of the bell-shaped curve, those that are newly infected would probably take about 10 years to go from the onset of infection to development of the disease, AIDS, acquired immune deficiency syndrome. And that's sort of the odd infectious diseases and malignancies and the wasting disease that you see. And once you have AIDS, then it's only a short time thereafter that you die, unless you can do something about it. And with the HIV drugs now, you can start those and you can actually shut off replication of the virus and repair the immune system. So repair the damage that has been done, at least to an extent. And if you catch it early enough and you put people on these very potent agents, which are very effective, you can essentially, at least with nowadays with the newer drugs, that these folks who are HIV positive have a near normal life expectancy.
So it's been changed from a death sentence into a chronic condition you have to live with.
Correct. And so it really is, in some ways, a lot like other chronic diseases that we deal with as physicians day to day.
Going back to the earlier days, what were the big questions of the medical community in the early years about this disease? What didn't we know then that we learned?
Well, I think the biggest question was whether we were ever going to come up with any drugs that would completely shut this virus down. It was a very clever virus, and it replicates rapidly, and it gets around drugs. And so we had to actually use a combination of very potent medications to bring it under control. And so we didn't know at the time that we were going to have such a combination. And so it was really the change in treatment, strategy changed. It changed the course of history with that disease. Again, at the time, I really had my doubts whether we were able to contain it with medications.
When you had patients come in who were HIV positive, what could you tell them then about the treatment? Certainly not as hopeful as today.
Oh, boy. Treatment was, even back then, was a bit of a hard sell because there was this sort of belief out there in the community, and ACT UP was, some people of ACT UP were promoting some of these concepts, and that drugs like AZT at the time, that which was the only drug available in the early 80s and mid-80s, that did as much harm as it did good. We had clinical trials that said, okay, it does slow down the process, but it certainly doesn't prevent the end outcome, which is death. So we had a lot of folks out there who were resisting some of those drugs because they heard about the horrors of AZT and its toxicity and things like that. And it was toxic, and we were using it in much higher doses than we use it now because we thought that it's the only drug we had, and we had to use a fairly high dose to have much effect.
Dr. Jeffrey Meyer is my guest, Associate Professor of Internal Medicine at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics, an infectious disease specialist who has been treating patients with HIV and AIDS since the early days of the epidemic, 30-plus years of this epidemic going on. Let's talk a little bit more about treatment. Also, listeners, join our conversation, please. 1-866-780-9100, river-to-river at iowapublicradio.org. Post a question or comment on our Facebook page at Iowa Public Radio or tweet us at IPR Talk. So when we talk about the antivirals that are used today, tell us a little bit more about them. They stop the progression of the HIV virus. Name some of these antivirals that are very effective.
Okay. I'll be happy to do that. There's one medication on the market, tenofovir, and another one called emtricitabine. These are complicated names, but you put the two together into one pill, and it's called Truvada. And Truvada is part of the backbone of a lot of the HIV treatment combinations that we use nowadays. That combination of drugs also makes up the pre-exposure prophylaxis that that you may talk about later, which is something that people who are not HIV positive will take to prevent them from getting HIV infection.
We can talk about that now, this pre-exposure prophylaxis or PrEP. This is something in the community that someone who has is not HIV positive can take, and they can then have sex. They don't have to worry about whether their partner has HIV or not.
Yeah. I would not say they don't have to worry. It is very effective, okay, and we do know from a variety of different kinds of clinical trials done in this country, other countries, Africa, so resource-limited parts of the world, it works, okay, as long as you take it. And it's a pill you have to take every day, and you miss doses, guess what, it doesn't work. But it's not a silver bullet. It doesn't, like, totally eliminate the risk, okay, and so we would still promote the use of condoms. Okay, but in an environment or community nowadays where condomless sex is increasing, we have to have other alternatives to bringing the epidemic under control, mm-hmm. And this is just one of those alternatives.
I understand that this drug Truvada is expensive.
It is expensive, and that's one of the drawbacks. It's far more expensive than it is in the United States than it is in other parts of the world.
Mm-hmm. Does health insurance pay for it?
Many of the insurance programs are paying for it. Some are not.
What has the advent of the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, meant for people with HIV or people seeking to steer clear of it with a drug like Truvada?
Well, that's a good question, and I don't know that I'm fully prepared to answer that one. I think there's so many different ways to buy in the market, insurance plans and so forth. So I think it's kind of difficult for me to just say across the board, oh, this is really making things easier and better. I don't have a sense of that right now. I mean, I do know that it seems to be easier than I thought getting this medication and prescribing it. There are also programs through the drug company that makes this medication to help reimburse or decrease the cost to the person, the client, if they can't afford it. Their insurance doesn't cover it.
Dr. Jeffrey Meyer, infectious disease specialist from the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics, my guest this half hour. Let's go back to the spread of it, the early days of the epidemic. I guess researchers, correct me if I'm wrong, have reasoned that a handful of people, maybe even a single individual, bore the responsibility for having introduced the disease to North America and its first large group of victims, the homosexual community. What is our understanding now of how HIV/AIDS spread in North America?
Well, there had been this favorite hypothesis years back, that there was this patient zero who was a flight attendant on a Canadian Airlines and had a fairly extensive network of partners. And there was some thought that he may have sort of brought in the United States and set up clusters of infections in some of the larger cities where there are major problems with HIV now. But I think that's sort of fallen by the wayside as we've generated more data in recent years indicating that it probably entered the United States earlier than it was once thought before patient zero, and it may have been coming through Haiti or other places via Africa. These are some of the hypothesis, prevailing hypothesis now as to how HIV entered the U.S.
Let's go to our caller. Dave is joining us from Des Moines. Dr. Jeffrey Meyer is our guest. Dave, welcome to our program. What question do you have, or do you have a comment?
Hey, thanks for having me. Let me jump in someplace quiet here. I have a kind of unique perspective on the disease. I was in the early 80s. Excuse me, I was running. I was stationed in the service on the tip of Cape Cod for a couple years in a place called Provincetown. And when this first broke, I call it the first die-off happened. There was, by the tens of thousands, this was kind of a gay summer place for men anyway, historically. And when this started happening, there was one female Unitarian minister that would actually talk to these men. And they came there to die, and no one would touch them, and they were shunned. And I can only liken it, and it was very contained. There wasn't much news about it. And I can only liken it to what it must have been like during the plagues of old Europe. And my perspective is this. I just hope, you know, now we have at least drugs that keep this disease in check. The next time one of these diseases manifests itself in our population, even though they were gay men and whatever that means to a population of people, I just remember that they were human beings and we just forgot them and they died alone and miserable. And the next time that something like that happens in our midst, no matter how scary it is, we try to have the understanding that they are our fellow citizens and they are human beings.
Dave, thank That's you for right. that view from Des Moines. Dr. Meyer, like the plague, did you have a feeling it was like that when you were a young doctor?
Yes, but, you know, I never really thought that the plague would become as huge as it was. I mean, at the time that I was in medical school and I was, you know, beginning to care for people who had HIV, we didn't know at the time that the problem in Africa was as immense as it is today. And so, I mean, to just the scale of the pandemic realized back in the early years.
Mm-hmm. HIV AIDS surveillance report, a report compiled by the Iowa Department of Public Health, said that 122 Iowans were diagnosed with HIV in 2013. 40% were considered to be late testers. What do you take away from this latest report? I understand that there is a slight increase in the HIV infections in Iowa last year. Why, and is it worrying?
Well, if you look back in time at the Iowa numbers, there have been a period of time where the Iowa numbers have been going up every year, and it looked like they were plateauing. So we'll have to sort of you know, keep an eye on this past year and see whether or not it's reproducible, see whether it continues to be a trend. I think so. The question is, why are we seeing more the numbers going up?
A small increase.
I really don't know. I think that, you know, the reason that we've had a trend upward over the years and the reason we have a syphilis outbreak now is because there's condomless sex. And so, you know, that's, I think, one of the underlying issues. And this idea of pre-exposure prophylaxis, that helps for preventing transmission of HIV, but that doesn't help for prevention of other STDs such as syphilis.
What do you see in the future? What will science do with HIV in the future? Wipe it out completely?
HIV, you think?
Yes. What is in the future for HIV? Will we always have that with us?
I would hope within my lifetime that I would see an effective HIV vaccine developed and you know, disseminated across the world. I think that's what it's going to take to really eliminate this disease, this infection. I think until then, we have to do with what we can do. And we know how to prevent transmission. And we've been implementing those public health measures for years, and they've only worked so good. And so we're trying new approaches such as PrEP to, you know, curtail the epidemic. We're trying another approach, which is test and treat. Test as many people as you can, get them into care as quickly as you can, keep them in care, and get their HIV viral load undetectable. Because if it's undetectable, the chances of them transmitting approach zero via sex. So I think that is really another strategy that we need to really work on with what we have today to work with.
Mm-hmm. In the minute or two we have left, can you tell me, as an infectious disease specialist, the biggest, the most common misperceptions people have about HIV/AIDS?
Ooh, I think still a misperceptions is how you get HIV, how HIV is transmitted. And I understand, you know, being back in 86, this happened to me. I had an exposure, and it was somebody just, I was dealing with somebody who had dementia and psychosis, and I was examining them up close, and they spit in my eyes. And at the time, I was an educated person. I was an ID-oriented person, infectious disease-oriented person. I knew how this was transmitted. But I had a rational fear for at least the evening and the next day. And I finally got over it. I said, this is crazy. You know, why am I feeling this way? And I think out in our communities, people still shun people who have HIV positive, that are HIV positive, because they're concerned that the virus is somehow going to be transmitted to their child or to their relative or even to them. And it's just not the way it works.
Dr. Jeffrey Meyer, it's been a pleasure having you on to tell us a little bit with a long perspective on the HIV/AIDS epidemic. Associate Professor of Internal Medicine at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics and Infectious Disease Specialist. Dr. Meyer, pleasure to have you on. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Coming up tomorrow on this program, Politics Day, we'll look at those three open congressional seats, the races for them. They're up for grabs in the midterm elections, and we'll analyze the primary results. Today is the primary for those races, and if you haven't checked out our 2014 voter guide at iowapublicradio.org, please do that. Go to iowapublicradio.org, look at the upper right part of the page, and you'll find connections to find out about all the candidates. And be sure to tune in for our analysis tomorrow with Tim Hagel and Kathy Obradovich. And River to River is produced by Lindsay Moon and Emily Woodbury. In Des Moines, we had help from John Pemble. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.